overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
These are strange times here in Huntsville, Alabama. It's June 6th, I believe. 6-6. Oh dear, if there was another 6, you know what that means. No, we don't abide by those limited ideas here. We're a spiritual community. And I ran into a young lady who was taking photographs of my garden this week, and she wants to be a spiritual counselor. She says, but I'm one of those kind of people that doesn't have a religion. I consider myself spiritual. I says, well, I've got the place for you, young lady. And she wants to go back and get her master's in theology and then her PhD in theology. And I said, well, if you humbly would receive a little bit of guidance from a 33-year ministry, is just work on yourself. The degrees aren't going to get you anywhere, but if you do the work on yourself, and it is a lifelong job, then you offer who you are to the world. And this month of June, somebody's phone is ringing. I just turned mine off. That means the universe is calling. Are you listening? But this month I wanted to speak about the big reveal. And I guess I've watched too much RuPaul's drag show, because they always have the big reveal at the end where they show you that we all wear all these masks, but underneath the masks there is this true self that ultimately wants to shine through. And what if we do all this stuff in life to acquire all these masks and all these labels and all these personality issues, perfect mother, perfect husband, perfect child, perfect minister, perfect... And when the masks fall away, well then, who's left? And so this month of June, we're going to talk about unveiling. And the Sufis say there are 70,000 veils that we wear. I know, 70,000, that's a hell of a lot, right, Sylvia? And they say it's very important that you lift them one veil at a time and that you do not tear the veil. So there might be the veil of your story, Terry boy, or there might be the veil of your expectations. There might be the veil of your resentments and bitterness over the stories of the past. And when these begin to lift, well, then who are we going to discover underneath all of that? That's what you get to discover. We taught that beautiful class, Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change, and Pema Chodron, this lovely Buddhist nun, reminds us that we all are victims of the Shempa of life. The Shempa of life is the stuff that triggers us, the stuff that shows us that we're not totally healed. We still have this unconscious pattern of resistance or projection or expectation. And if you have any of that, you're going to suffer because of that. So when you can see it, though, when you are conscious of these unconscious patterns, well, then you say, ah, there I go again. Someone reminded me earlier that they say these patterns keep coming around. I thought I'd conquered that one, and Tia so beautifully reminded me, no, it just keeps coming around. There she is. There's fearful Freddie, or there's curious Connie, or there's critical Curtis, and you're not going to get rid of them. My friend Seamus has Arnie the, well, I'm not even going to say what he is, and but we all have one. You can figure that one out. And he shows up at the most amazing times, and I think Arnie's become part of the family. And so you learn to live with these aspects of our egoic self, but we don't identify as that. So the big reveal is to reveal this imprisoned splendor, to reveal this peace that passes all understanding, to reveal an unconditional love that doesn't need other in order for this love to shine through. And so this Sunday, I'm daring to talk about the pull of existence, that the universe longs to reveal itself through a Jack and through a Catherine. It's not about a Catherine or a Jack. It's about being a conduit for this something to express as us, to let the divinity of our being shine through. Wow, is that too big of an idea to play with? You know, in religious science, we talk about the local mind and the non-local mind. The local mind is you. It's your story, it's your opinions, it's your judgments. It's the illusion that we live with. It's where all the dream that you've created. And it might not be such a happy dream, it might be a miserable dream, but ultimately we get to dream a new dream. We get to have a new awareness. And when we start operating from this creative intelligence, not our local mind, well then we can write the God equation, because God is moving through. We have a poster in the men's bathroom. It's a big picture of Albert Einstein that says, I don't want to know what man thinks, I want to know what God thinks. Now this isn't an abstract idea, because all there is God. All there is this creative intelligence unveiling itself intimately to each one of us. And then we get to ask that simple existential question, to be or not to be, to be who you are, not who you ain't. Because if you who you ain't who you is. And if you ain't who you is, well then who is you? So really explore, who am I? Am I this expression of divine love? Am I the creative intelligence of the universe? Or am I this little neurotic man in Huntsville, Alabama, who's got opinions and belief systems and criticisms and judgments? Yeah, he might be in there, but he's not running the show anymore. I'm living with a very old dog. He's 16 years old. I've got a 10-year-old pug, and I've got a 73-year-old husband. I don't know who's the oldest in that group, but sometimes it's a challenge to live with that energy, because it tends to be sluggish, it tends to have issues. Incontinence is one of them. I woke up this morning and Bertram had urinated over himself lying in the downstairs. So at 5 a.m. we're taking him out and washing him down, and I'm telling him it's okay. I know it was an accident, you didn't mean to do it. And in this whole dynamic, I'm realizing this is my journey right now. And I've learned from a hospice worker years ago, when the AIDS crisis was in full thing, when I came to Huntsville, and they were really dying quite all the time. There was no cure at that time. And I learned, as I'm going through someone who's going through the dying process, is to honor their journey, honor their process, however it might look. Not that it should be convenient for me, but sometimes it's about an old dog who urinates on himself, who can't stand, who I have to pick up. And then I smell of his urine and I think, oh, I'm smelling like Bert. Oh, and I don't consider it bad. I can see how a mother would be with a baby, you know? It's not like it's bad smell, it's just Bert's smell. And I know that it offends Trey, and so I scrub him down with soap and water, and he says, well, you know, I didn't mean to do it. And I said, I know you didn't mean to do it. And then I'm having a conversation with myself, or am I having a conversation with Bert? I don't really know. But I do know that God shines through that animal, and when I'm with him, there is a resonance at the soul level. It was Rumi that said, there is a window in the heart, and when the window in the heart is open, then love can flow from heart to heart. And then Rumi says, but if there is no wall between us, what need is there of a window? So there is no wall between Bertram and me. There is just this love that's flowing continually. And yes, he's not the puppy that could prance and be the belle of the ball. Now he's got ODS, old dog syndrome. And I think there's a few of you out there that maybe suffer from the same thing. His hips don't work as well as they used to. You know, I have to prop him up. Sometimes he falls over. But, you know, you still love him. You don't put them down because they're getting older. You cherish them in their old, sweet, addled ways. Sometimes he walks to the guest bedroom. That's where baby, the love of his life, used to sleep. And he stares and looks, thinking he still sees her in the corner. I said, Bert, she's not over there. But maybe she is. I'm not even sure. So I'm going to explore the idea of the pull of existence this Sunday morning. And I thought of a Sufi story years ago that, and you know, the great mystics, they wouldn't talk logically. They wouldn't give you left brain stuff to chew on. They would give you metaphor and parable. If you want to understand the teachings of Jesus, read the parables, because they speak in a right brain language that paints a picture. And like Jack said, you see things in symbols, and the symbols speak volumes. So here's the symbol that I'm going to give you. It's a Sufi story about the lake at the top of the mountain. And the lake was aching for the ocean. Or was it the ocean that was aching for the lake? And so the water in the lake decided, if she were to get to the ocean, that she would have to convert and become a little stream. And she would leave the comfort from her little lake on top of that mountain. And she would be the humble little stream that would go down the mountain on her way to the ocean, because the ocean is calling the stream home. But ultimately, the stream ran into a desert. And she didn't know how she was going to cross the desert in order to get to the ocean. And so the universe says, you're going to have to surrender your nature as the stream, and you're going to have to let yourself become vapor and lift up and become a cloud. And now, as the little stream became the cloud, now you're going to have to surrender to the wind and let the wind take you where you need to go. And so the little lake became the stream, became the cloud, and she was trusting in the wind to carry her over the ocean. And when conditions were right, she let go of her attachment to being the cloud, and she descended as raindrops and returned home to the ocean. Now, this is a metaphor for what is happening with us. I know as a young minister, Judy was there, Tia was there, Gigi was there. You weren't quite there, Sylvia. You had left by this time. But there came a time in my ministry where I was being pulled by something that was so much greater. I think Dorothy Edwards even left the church because she couldn't stand me standing up here crying, because I was falling into this something that was greater than me. It was the ocean calling the drop home. And then I would read somebody like Rumi, and I would bring it to the congregation, and they didn't want to hear what I was giving them. Rumi would say, oh, drop, to be wooed by the ocean. They say, give it up, drop. The ocean for a drop? Who wants to stay the drop when you're the whole ocean? And of course, when you're taking it as a direct experience, tears are coming down, because in a sense, you're dying to this identity of me, and you're moving into an identity. You're being revealed as the very presence that you are divine love. And so then I would read things to the congregation 20 years ago, that all swimming in the ocean of love ends in drowning. Now people looked at me, what is he talking about? When you decide to merge with this divine love, who you are as separate from that dies. And then all that's left is the love. All that's left is this presence. Now, is that too big of a dynamic that is happening? Beautiful Michael Gott came here to sing one Sunday, and I went out after church and had lunch with him, and he says, David, you got to help me. There's this ache, this pull of my soul. And he said, I don't know what this is all about. And he said, I said to him, Michael, I said, what if it's the divine pulling you? It's not you aching for the divine. And it's as if I let him off the hook. You mean there is this something that is longing for me? Yes. And it won't be satisfied until you surrender into that. So I'm going to explore this pull of existence this Sunday and see if you can feel your way into it. I want to start with, and you know, there's so many teachers that point toward that. And right back in ninth grade, Self-Reliance, the Emerson essays, I've taught them a gazillion times. And my favorite essay of the whole bunch is the essay on the Oversoul, because he talks about this is what we are. Now here's Hinduism. What science of mind is applied Hinduism. There's Brahman, which is the power of the universe. And Brahman and Atman are one. Atman is the soul. And we are all the Oversoul. There's one soul, the soul of the universe. So Brahman and Atman are one. And if we would know and feel the pull of existence, we have to allow ourselves to discover the soul nature. And I love the way Emerson put it in the 1830s. This is what he says. He says, what we commonly call man, the eating, drinking, planting, counting man, does not, as we know him, represent himself. He misrepresents himself. Him we do not respect. So all of you counting and achieving and getting, yeah, that's not what we respect. He says, but the soul whose organ he is, we are an organ of the soul, would he let it appear through his actions, would make our knees bend. When you see the soul in expression, you literally fall to your knees. It's such a beautiful expression. He says, when it breathes through his intellect, it is genius. When it breathes through his will, it is virtue. When it flows through his affections, it is love. And the blindness of the intellect begins when it would be something of itself. We have to get beyond the idea that we can understand this, Terry girl. It's not a mental concept. It's a felt awareness of the soul. So he goes, he says, the weakness of the will begins when the individual would be something of himself. And all reform aims in some one particular to let the great soul have its way through us. To let the ocean of love pour itself through you. The ocean of peace, know in these midst of crazy times that we are that peace. All reform aims in some one particular to let the great soul have its way through us. In other words, to engage us to obey. And then he quotes one of the Sufi poets who said, God sighs to become known in us as the great revelation. God sighs to be known in us as the great revelation. So this is the revelation that we're going to dance around throughout this whole month. The revelation of God in you, through you, as you. All there is God. And then what would that look like? If God would dance through you, would you be an Isadora Duncan, or would you be a trained dancer who choreographed and told people how to dance? Would you be, you know, I'm reading a book by Kabir Helminski. Gigi and I traveled with him 15 years ago. We were in Istanbul and traveled throughout Turkey. And he talks about, his new book is called The House of Remembrance. And in the Sufi tradition, in the mystic tradition, they talk about this presence that's everywhere, and it's all about remembering it. You know, it was there when you probably had your child, when you had Joshua. And then when Joshua left the planet, that presence was there. To experience this as a living reality. He talks about traveling with the Sufis and how they stress the idea of the Sangha, of the community. And that's why they always meet in circles. And Gigi and I met in many a Sangha. And we would all meet in a vibrational field of resonance, of coherence. La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah. There is nothing but God. There is nothing but God. Jack and I would be going, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah. Catherine would be right there, la ilaha. After a while, there was no Catherine and Jack and David. There's just Allah, which means the nothingness, the emptiness. And that's what we are. Wow. And then you learn the name, Allah, the emptiness. And so when you inhale, you're taking in the presence. Now, this is a felt experience. And when Gigi and I left that journey, we weren't really separate. We were part of this community of dervishes. And a dervish is someone who's at the threshold between heaven and earth. And what if we know that we are always at the threshold between heaven and earth? Heaven is a state of consciousness. And even Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind says, keep your conversation in heaven. We're not talking about a geographical location. We're talking about a conversation in this open-hearted awareness that is what we are. So one of the chapters in Kabir's book was moving from content to context. Now, I love this because it's a left brain thing that maybe you can understand. The content is all the things that we identify with, our thoughts, our beliefs, our expectations, our conclusions. When we had the Sadhguru speak here at the center, I watched the video, 2-hour video. All he talked about was we're victim of our conclusions. Could we let go of our conclusions? That we have the answers for anybody? And when you do, you move out of the content. And you know, the Baptist church has their content. The Catholic church has their content. The Jewish church has their content. What if he said, Kabir, we know that we are the context. We are the space in which all content arises. You know, thoughts are things and they're creative. And some people have stinking thinking and some people have positive thinking. But it's not about positive or negative. What is neither positive or negative? It's androgynous. There's that something that holds both the positive and negative, and that doesn't identify with either. That's the context. One way you might understand it, we taught a class called Shift into Freedom here by Locke Kelly, and he said, I used to think that I was this nice little white fluffy cloud in the sky, and my job was to keep my cloud nice and clean and white, and not all troubled and dark and everything else. And he says, and then one day, I went, holy cow, I'm the sky. I'm not the cloud. I am the context in which all clouds arise. So what if I told you, you are the sky? You are the infinite sky of mind, not your local mind. And so when we do spiritual mind treatment, what essentially we're doing is we're moving from the local mind into the infinite mind. So what would God know here? What would love know here? A love that isn't attached, a love that isn't possessive. I was talking to my prayer partner, and he has many relationships going, and it's all about the jealousy in the relationships, one or the other. And he says, I'm the kind of person that has multiple relationships with many, many people. And if you're jealous that I talk to Michael or Tia and that is too much for you, he says, then maybe we're not destined to be in relationship. I love to think of love as like a butterfly. And the butterfly is the symbol for the soul. And if you hold your hand out, the butterfly can land on your hand. Now, if you say, that's my butterfly, you're going to kill the butterfly. I know Tia went like this. But if you know that the butterfly of Tia will come and land on David's hand, and then she'll land on Seamus's hand, and before you know it, she'll be on every hand in the room, and Seamus will laugh and I will laugh, because that's the nature of the soul. The soul, by its very nature, is free. Could we stretch our imagination, the divine imagination, and have a bigger sense of who we are in this world? Now, that's been my lifelong endeavor, is to constantly evolve and grow into what Barbara Marx Hubbard calls the homo universalis, the individual that does the work on themselves. So when the shadow stuff appears, we don't make it wrong. We see it as a doorway to liberation. Then everything is a gift, and everything is from God. Jody did a beautiful spiritual mind treatment at the end of our revealing service, and she reminded us that life is giving us the exact lesson we need at the particular moment we're getting it. And sometimes those lessons are painful, like me going through this transition with Bert. But what if I could just shift the way I see it and see it as a sacred time? And he's my great teacher now. You know, he's not complaining. He's not really suffering. He's just losing the control over his physical body, but his spiritual body is still intact. And it's my expectation that he should give me the young Bert when he's actually 142 years old in human years. And I wouldn't expect that of any of you at 142. So why am I expecting him to act like Jack and prance around like he used to do? No. He's the old guy, and he's got ODS, old dog syndrome. And I just talked to him like that. And he says, well, you know, I wish I could prance. And he did see a young filly. She was walking down the street, looked a little bit like the baby. And he got a little bit of the prance going. His tail started working. I said, your tail works, Bert. He goes, oh, well, sure, it works. You know, I still have something in me. And then you do the dance, and you honor their journey. And it's really sacred. And you see, this is here for me. This is here for me. On my Zen calendar, they were quoting Lao Tzu, who's one of the founders of Taoism, which is a nature religion. It says, all is the Tao. That means all is the presence and the 10,000 things. We as humans get caught up in the 10,000 things when we realize it's all the Tao. And the Tao means the way. Now, to have a power, not God, but to have something called the way, and the way operates through its creation. So Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father but by me, not by Jesus, but by the way, by the Tao, you know, by the light, by the love, by the peace. And he's pointing the way. And what if all these great teachers were pointing the way to the truth and we've been worshiping their finger? It's not about Jesus. It's not about any of the great avatars. It's about the truth that they were exposing to us. Now, can we hear the truth? The Greek word for truth is that which unhides itself. The truth is there all along. Can we be willing to hear the truth when we have an addictive pattern? Can we see it for what it is? That's what the contemplative practice is. Richard Rohr, this beautiful Franciscan monk, he teaches contemplative practice. And a contemplative is one who looks at the stuff of life and sees it for the illusion that it is, for the trap that it is, for the addictive pattern that it is. And when you see it for what it is, you have this ability to detach with love. Terry Boy knows what it is. Instead of miring yourself in that stuff, you say, well, there's that pattern again that I unconsciously seem to need because I keep going there. But there comes a time when you don't need that pattern anymore. My daughter, Terry girl, she used to do a catastrophizing thing. She outgrew it. It just happened on a Wednesday night. Boom. Catastrophizing left. What happened to her? She'll come around again. They have a way of recycling. But for now, there's this sense of freedom. So did she lift a veil? Perhaps. And what if we get to do that all the time? It's a never-ending journey. One of my heroes on the path is a young man named Mark Nepo. He's maybe 2 years younger than me. And in his surviving cancer twice and his willingness to go within and do the work on himself, he talked about how we get to lift these veils in a very creative way. And I thought I'd give you something somewhat practical, because Jack's a little confused about what the veils are. And this is how Mark Nepo described the lifting of the veils. Nice Jewish boy. He says this, I've learned that life covers us with its veils. And living this life lifts the veils. And we must remain devoted to the lifting of the veils throughout our whole existence. You know, Trey worries a lot. I try not to have the veil of worry. Worry is faith in limited ideas. Sylvia knows that. So if you worry, you're really investing in a limited thought. So what if the veil of worry just lifts and I have Jody's beautiful faith and trust and accepting things as they are? So we must remain devoted to the lifting of the veils throughout our existence. He says we all collaborate with the universe then in adding to the joy of existence. We add to the universe by our being here. That says volumes. We need you to bring the joy to the planet. We need you to bring this peace to the planet. If you want peace on the planet, it's all an inside job. You have to find the peace in here. If you want to find a loving relationship out there, you have to be love incarnate in here. And you know what happens when love awakens in here? Everyone becomes your lover. Every tree, every chipmunk, every bird. That's how love works. It doesn't see other. So he says, this is our work in being here, to lift the veils. And he goes on to explain this through the Hindu tradition. In the Hindu tradition, Maya refers to the veils of illusion. In the shamanic tradition, they say we're all dreaming this into existence. So look at your life, what you've created. You know, and if you've lived as long as Nancy and I, you can see how the dream changes. Holy cow, I dreamed that once, and I don't dream that anymore. So could I dream where we all get along, where hearts open, where there's deepest acceptance, where all are created equal? So Maya is the power or the veil that conceals our true nature and our spiritual reality. So where is the Maya in your life? Where are the dreams? Where are the illusions? Where are the labels? Because it blocks you from experiencing the big reveal. The Upanishads describe the universe and our human experience as an interplay of Purusha, which is the eternal unchanging principle, and Prakriti, which is the temporary changing material world. When I started studying Hinduism, I realized, my God, this is applied religious science. It goes right back to Sri Aurobindo. So Ernest Holmes was studying the world's great teachings. So there's this presence, it's unchanging and eternal, and then there's this illusory changing stuff, which is that which comes and goes, which is the Maya, which is what we tend to identify with. Comes right out of Hinduism, the temporary changing material world. Now, he says, the former, this unchanging presence, manifests itself as the Atman, or the soul self, and the latter, as Maya, is the veil of illusion which gets trapped in our egoic identifications, the me. Now, if there's only one sin, the sin is that we think we're separate from Source. And then we think it's me and Source. There is no separation in oneness. So when we can know ourselves as the Atman, which is the Brahman in expression, then we don't misrepresent ourselves, as Emerson would say. Lastly, he goes on to say this, just what kind of veils then are we talking about? He says there are so many, but here are just a few for you to consider. There's the veils of our memories. Oh, could I tell you about my past? The veils of our memories, the veils of our regrets, the one that done you wrong. Oh gosh, give him a break. The veil of ambition and striving for more or better. The veil of expectation. To me, that's the biggest no-no. Do not have any expectations of me, please. I remember we had a board member who was angry at me. And I said, you're angry because you have expectations. I do have expectations. He said, well, that's why you're suffering. Mm-hmm. I'm not the kind of person that you wanted. The veil of expectations, the veils of fear. We have a lot of fear in the world. The veil of woundedness. The veil of self-centeredness. And the veil of familiarity. If you always do what you've always done, well, you'll always get what you've always gotten. You know, that's the definition of insanity. You know, we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and we expect different results. But when that veil is lifted, like my Terry boy learned, then the Shempa goes away. Oh, that's just that Shempa pattern. You know, my expectation of the construction workers. And when I have no expectation, well, then I'm not suffering. Is it that simple? Yeah, it's that simple. So we get to lift the veils, and what are we exposing? What are we exposing? That's the question you get to answer. That's why we do our meditation. And to sit in the silence and observe who's showing up. You know, who am I being in this moment? Am I being playful? Am I being, you know, the Bible says to be like a child if you would enter the kingdom. Now that doesn't mean to be childish. That means to be childlike. Children have a sense of wonder and awe, and they're spontaneous. My sister sent me a video of my little nephew at the beach, and I think he's 1.5 years old, and he's running down the beach, and he's screaming and twirling and screaming and twirling, and everybody's laughing because he's an absolute free spirit. He hasn't been programmed to be self-conscious or, you know, appropriate. He's just a free spirit dancing on the beach, barefoot in the sand, expressing his soul, his jubilant and beholden soul. So we get to find out then, how does the pull of existence court you and me? Now, for me as a young person, I was born to be a dancer. As a little boy, one of the big scandals was my parents were drinkers and they would have parties. There were cigarette ashtrays. I remember getting up as a 5-year-old, overflowing cigarette butts, empty whiskey glasses. And anybody resemble that? Yeah, childhood, yeah. And they would leave all the records, the LPs at that time. There were 78 LPs. And so as a little 5-year-old, I was dancing around and I broke my dad's LP collection. Oh, he was furious, you know, the little 5-year-old. But I was just dancing and having fun. And from then on, I knew it wasn't good to dance, because if you dance, you get spanked. Until later on, when I could dance. But then when I could dance, it wasn't because I wanted to do formula dance. It's because when I would express, my soul was expressing. And so even to this day, I'll put some beautiful music on in the garden, and I'll find myself moving around the garden, and my body craves this expression of the soul. So what if each one of us, sometimes it paints through the soul, as Emerson would say, sometimes it comes out as genius when the intellect is coming from this higher sense of knowing. Sometimes virtue comes out when you're in service to something greater than you and you're being pulled into service. So could we discover how our soul uniquely is being pulled into a creative expression? I went to my little Anthony DeMillo book called Wellsprings. He is a Dominican monk. I think he's Dominican. I'm not sure. It could be Benedictine. He's not Franciscan. And he wrote a little book called Wellsprings. And it's all about how the universe is coming through us. One little event after the other. And I picked one of his little things where I felt being pulled by existence. And I want to share this with you. The wellsprings of life are the pull of existence that reveal the beauty of the soul, he writes. So here's how he puts it. I seek the sources of this refreshment, of this sustenance, of this healing, that my spirit, like my body, is constantly in need of. The body needs this jolt of spirit. The mind needs this ponder the imponderable. The soul needs this expression that is an eternal expression where meaning comes from. So he's saying, I am made whole again. Myself is given back to me in the solitude and in the silence. Be still and know that I am God. Stillness is the language of God. Everything else is a poor translation. Go sit in the garden and hold a rock and listen to what the rock is saying to you. It's not going to be a convoluted sentence from the mind. It's going to tell you something about ancient eternal peace, perhaps. How loving it is. Anybody have a pet rock? Am I the only one? It's not dumb. It's not a dumb thing. Okay, I am made whole again. Myself is given back to me in solitude and silence, and I feel the pull of existence. He goes on to say, so now I seek to silence my words and my thoughts by being conscious of all the sounds around me, or the sensations of my body, or my breathing. For whom the bell tolls for thee. When you wake up in the morning and you hear the birds singing outside, could you think of it as the song of existence? The universe is singing to you, not because it has a message for you to contemplate, a thought pattern to figure out, but it has a song that it wants to sing. We were lying in bed the other morning and there was this loud bird singing right outside the Botanica. And it had two beep, beep, and then beep, 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 beep. And then beep, 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 beep. And I said, Trey, you know the birds? What? He said, I don't have a clue what it is. So I went out and I looked, and there was this cardinal sitting right over there. Beep, 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 beep. And I said, he's looking for his lover, isn't he? He's calling for his friend to come. And for the longest time, I and the cardinal were having this little love affair. And he says, I'm energized by love itself. Now, love. What is love? Even just saying that, I'm energized by love itself. Now, first the mind is in there and has a concept of love, doesn't it? But what if you don't have a concept of love? Energized by love itself. Can you feel the love in this room? Can you feel the love that was put into these yantras? Virginia Burroughs did these, the world's religions. You know, can you feel the love in the Thich Nhat Hanh, I have arrived, I am home? You know, to know that you're already home. And when you find that place of home, not a geographical place, but a place within, and that home is filled with love. When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing. I wish I was home. I wish I was back there with the things I am knowing. So when you begin to know that this is all the one life, and you are that life, and that life is love itself, wow, then you can go home just by touching your heart and looking in Jack's eyes and smiling, and you've arrived home. Is it that simple? Click your heels 3 times, if you would know. So he says, I'm energized by love. And so he says, this is a monk, I recapture and relive the times when I have felt loved, have been cared for and treasured. If you've ever known love, you know, if you've ever had a pet that just stole your heart, all you have to do, when we do the Sufi meditation, they talk about, it's called the love meditation. And the way they teach it is they say, image something that you dearly love. You know, it could be a human, could be your grandmother, could be one of your pets. And they say, see that image, could be your beautiful husband, and then let the image dissolve and stay in that vibration of love. And then you rest and you go deeper in the meditation. They were just the catalyst. They were just the reflection of love. But now you don't need the form in order to experience the love. So Anthony DeMillo, he says, when I feel the energy of love, I frequently remember who nurtured me. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote this beautiful little book called The Gift of Roses. And he was at a conference once, and they gave every mother, everyone who had a mother, a red rose. And if your mother was deceased, you got a white rose. And so he does this beautiful treatise on how the love of the mother never left. He said, I feel her with me all the time, and I'm carrying the white rose around. So could we have that same experience with love? He say, and I see myself going out in love, going to my friends and to those who are in need and to every living creature, and I'm pulled by love's reality. You know, where does love want to show up today? How does it want to help? You know? And the neighbor, he likes to rescue things across the street, and he's always rescuing old historic things that people throw out on the side of the curb. And the other day he had these 2 old windows from turn of the century, and he said, I just can't see them being thrown in the trash. And I said, well, I have a friend of mine that loves old windows and things. He says, well, tell your friend to come on down. So less than 24 hours later, there were Tia and Shay, and we took the old windows that were going to be thrown out, and with love, she took them, and I know that she is going to restore them into a way that has this adab, this respect. You know, he says, I come alive in times of creativity. This is the pull of the universe. How does it find expression in my life, I wonder? How does that creative something make birdhouses that are magical? Well, I don't know. It just does, doesn't it, Jude? How does this creative something paint over old windows that makes them look like stained glass right out of... Well, I don't know. It just happens. How does this creative something dance through a David where he doesn't know who he is? I don't know. It just kind of moves through me. So he's asking the same thing. Where does this creativity come from? And how does it find expression in my life? And then he says, and then I get peace and I get healing from my roots in nature. I can't count the number of times people tell me to go for a walk in nature is more therapeutic for their soul than just about anything. Why would that be? Because nature is the thinnest veil to spirit. Emerson calls it a mute gospel. In other words, it's speaking a message, but it's a message of silence. Could we take communion with the tree, the old tree in the garden? Could we sit by the brook and know that the brook is fluidic and flowing and is telling us to flow and not to cling to the side but to always be moving? Could we be surprised by the beauty that we see all around us, knowing that it's only beauty that sees the beauty, and that a happy person will see beauty in the same place that an unhappy person will see ugliness? And then you can affirm that I am beautiful and you are beautiful and the whole existing universe is beautiful, and you're creating a dream where beauty sees beauty. Is it that crazy? That's the existence of beauty, and that's what we are. Truth is beauty, beauty is truth. Is it that simple? Yeah. Well, isn't it a convoluted conclusion and an idea? No, never has been. You want it to be a thought, you want it to be a conclusion, you want it to be a doctrine, but it's nothing like that. What is God but a simple essence, the cost of which is nothing less than everything? So could we let it all go and experience that simple essence? In Barbara Marx Hubbard's book, Emergence, she talks about ultimately what is to emerge through all of us is what she calls the essential self, which is the true nature, which is the part of us that doesn't have conclusions or preferences. It doesn't say, oh, it's a good day because it's sunny, and it's a bad day because it's a rainy day. No, the essential self says, it's a day. With my neighbor, she has stage 4 colon cancer, and he likes to say, well, she had a bad day today, she had a good day. I said, can't they just be a day? Instead of a bad day or a good day, it's a day. You know, today was the day that Bert had a bladder problem. Was it a bad day? No, it was a good day. He got a nice bath, and you know, I told him he was loved. I thought it was a good day. He says, I recall what happens when I'm in harmony with the earth and with the sky, with the mountains and the rivers and the oceans, and nature's many moods and nature's many seasons. And I say to nature, teach me and show me the way. It says in the Quran, am I not your Lord? To which we, the creation, say, yes, we witness you. So could we witness the creation of all of this as the expression of God? Wheresoever I look, I see the face of God. It's not somewhere up there. It's all around us. Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is spread upon the earth, and we don't see it. So could we see it all as the pull of existence revealing itself? The revealing is all. And when you see the revealing out here, it starts to invite the revelation within yourself. It's a realization that it's all one, and then it's a revelation from within us that's ongoing and it never ends. Lastly, he says, I find this pull of existence in prayer. Now, he's a Catholic, so here's how he says prayer. I find the pull of existence in prayer, which is for me fragrance and food. Prayer is a home, a shield, and a tonic. Huh. And I recall the seasons of my prayer, the moments I cry out in despair. One of the greatest prayers you can do is help, you know, and then open to receive grace. The moments I cry out in despair, the prayer, the days of glad thanksgiving. To live in gratitude is one of the most beautiful ways to pray. The prayer that is the time of simple stillness and presence and adoration. Simple stillness, presence, and adoration. This is his prayer. And I recite, he says, a prayer, a song, or a poem that I have come to love, that I wish to have beside me all through my life, and I shall want my lips to say this in the moment when I am dying. To have a prayer, a song, a poem that comes from love, to be in me, so even at the moment of death, I could say that prayer. And I thought, I was reading in this garden, and I thought, what song would I sing? Maybe Karen Drecker, you are the face of God. I hold you in my heart. You are a part of me, whatever I'm looking at. You are the face of God. And then I heard the song, you are the ancient glow that lights the dawn. The dearest things I know are what you are. Someday my happy heart will hold you, and someday I'll know that moment divine when all the things you are mine. And so it's as if this pull of the universe comes through the most maudlin, simple love song. And what was the song I heard the other day? Oh, the very thought of you. Now think of the divine presence. And I forget to do the simple, ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I see your face in every flower. Boy, do I see them in flowers. In your eyes, in skies above, twinkling down from heaven. The very thought of you. The very thought of you. I love. Now this is a love song to the universe. Or is it a love song from the universe to us? I ask you. So here's your assignment, if you should choose to take it. Ask yourself, what poem, what song, What prayer would you like to be uttering at that moment when you shift out of form and you return to essence? Boy, the soul will respond, I promise you. It won't be something like money, 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 money. I don't think your soul is going to give you that song. But then again, if it does, you've got a ways to grow. And that's all there is to it. So let's just touch that God space within us and feel the ache of spirit. They talk in the Sufi tradition about a longing. And beautiful John O'Donohue talks about belonging. And he uses this way of phrasing it. He says, be the longing, and that will take you to belonging. So the longing is God's longing to reveal herself through her creation. And it is all her creation. And we are an aspect of that creation. So when we open to this ache of the divine in us to express, to know, to feel, to celebrate the life that we've been given, then we're coming home. We're coming home to the creative impulse of the universe. We're coming home to the breath within the breath. We're coming home to the delight of the universe. As Dr. Ernest Holmes says, man was created for the delight of God. So how would this divine presence delight itself through each one of us? We don't have to put that into our mind to think about. We can take it into our heart, the one heart, the heart of the universe, and invite your heart to open. When the heart is open, then love can flow from heart to heart. And it is the one heart of love itself, awakening in time and space, and we are that. So we make a vow, as Emerson would say, to allow ourselves to be done by this incredible creative intelligence. And so placing your hand over your heart, let's join in the heart salutation, which says, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
The beloved within bows to the beloved within you. In this spacious contextual place, we are one.
In this spacious contextual place, we are one.
Now we open our eyes, we open our hands, we open our soul, and we let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Is it that simple? It's that simple.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.